Hey everyone, Blake Crash Priddle here, and it's good to be back after a long winter break. This time on The Medley, we're going to be speaking with Dominic Carty, the leader of the New Canadian Future Party. Dominic Carty has an extensive political resume, and the Canadian Future Party offers an alternative for those that may not be satisfied with the current parties in the House of Commons. In this interview, you're going to learn all about what the party has to offer and how it stands out from the other parties. And you'll also get to learn a little bit more about Dominic Carty's political background. Now, most people that follow politics know who you are, but for those that don't, who is Dominic Carty?
The leader of the Canadian Future Party. I've had an interesting political career. I worked overseas for an American organization for a long time across Asia and Africa. Got to see lots of conflict and post-conflict countries up close and work on democratic development, things like trying to convince Afghan politicians to come out of hiding after 9/11 to holding the first ever TV debates in Cambodia. Lots of years doing that. But before that, I worked for the NDP. And after that, I came home because I was spooked about what I was seeing around the world and the rise of dictators and autocrats. I thought I need to get back home and to put my money where my mouth is and not tell other people to bump up their democracy, but work on my own. And so I was first leader of the NDP here in New Brunswick for a few years, then became the chief of staff for the then opposition PC leader, then became a candidate and got elected and became education minister for 4 years and got to help guide New Brunswick through COVID. That my now wife and I wrote a paper in February of 2020 that helped guide our province's response to COVID, which included some of the first lockdowns in anywhere in the Western world and some really serious restrictions that allowed us to get through the first year or so of COVID nearly unscathed and live a very normal life. So that was my time until I left government over an issue of principle. The premier was moving the party far to the right, which he had promised not to do. Was not interested in that. And at the same time, watching the horrors of the war in Ukraine, a country I've cared about for a long time. I was there in 2014 to monitor the presidential elections just after Putin invaded and occupied Crimea and began the attack on the Donbass. And looking around the world and talking with people, both from my overseas career, but also more and more Canadians going, we need something here in Canada that actually stands up for some sort of evidence-based, data-driven, realism-based approach to politics that's going to defend the best of what Western civilization has given us, that openness, rights for people, rights for normal individuals to participate as active members in politics, all these things that seem to be slowly sliding away through a combination of sort of cynicism because we live in an incredibly successful country, which is not being, I think, particularly well run at the moment, but also the rise of social media that allows leaders, autocrats, and very wealthy people to beam their messages into the heads of billions without consequence. And at the same time, the rise of the autocrats, Xi, Putin, sadly, I think I would now argue being joined by Trump, and the decline of democracy. So I think it's time for a drawing a line in the sand and saying no further, that we're going to build a democratic coalition here in Canada, which is what my party is all about, bringing people who've been involved in all parties and none together. And also creating those links with folks in other democracies and saying that we've got to defend that democratic sandbox, saying that within a world that recognizes free speech, individual rights, the rule of law, that we should be able to talk to each other with much greater levels of respect and openness. But also we need to be equally firm in rejecting those ideas that go outside of that box and saying, you know what? Democracy is the only valid form of government, because it's the only one that rests on the consent of the people who are being governed. And we've got to break away from this idea that this is a ethnically or regionally based idea. This is a universal human drive. We just happen to have been lucky enough because of a random series of events to be one of the countries that was first able to take advantage of that step in human evolution. The last thing that we can do on our watch is let this generation be the generation that sees democracy die because we couldn't be bothered to defend it. So my unlikely political project now is building the Canadian Future Party to prepare for whatever the future is going to throw at us, which right now looks pretty bleak. But I've got a team of people around me that I'm incredibly impressed with. It's growing every day because more and more people are seeing that.
Well, you mentioned leaving the Progressive Conservative Party in New Brunswick because the leader at the time moved the party too far to the right. Do you feel that that's the same reason that you left the NDP, not because obviously they were too far to the right, but maybe too far to the left?
Yeah, I think I'm one of the only Canadian politicians who has got two fairly aggressive resignation letters on record, both leaving two parties for different forms of extremism. That when the NDP started to openly encourage Marxists to be involved again, and we can see the consequences of that with the NDP's functional collapse as an effective political force, and also bizarrely claiming that it was a party of pacifism when the party's founder, Tommy Douglas, did his very best to trick the draft boards to let him join the military in World War II. They wouldn't let him because he had a bad leg. So, and leaving the conservatives for the same reason, that they refused to close the door to populists and cranks and the hard right, that we've got to have a politics where Marxists and fascists are excluded, where people who reject science and evidence don't get to claim that their perspectives are equal to those who use science and evidence. And we've got to get back to saying there are some things that are real and some things that aren't. And that's a fundamental task of a political party and any political project. And the fact that we've slid away from that is partly a testament of our own success as a country, that we've done so well and we've been so wealthy and are so free in comparison to just about everywhere, just about always, that it's hard for us to imagine that things could really get bad. But we've got to start making ourselves better prepared for the challenges that are going to come at us. And that has to come by, as I'd like to say, I'm not talking here about being a centrist in terms of a mushy middle. I'm talking about a hard center. That it's got to be something where there are clear limits on what we're talking about, and that we make it very clear that the folks who are trying to undermine small L liberal democracy from the left and the right, both of them not coincidentally receiving financial and other amplifications and support from Russia, China, and Iran, that's all documented by our security forces. There's a reason why they support those different groups on both extremes, because it helps to undermine democracy, which is what they're all about. So let's not make their job easy for them. Let's redefine what democracy means for the 21st century. Talk about how we make our programs deliver so we don't have the embarrassment of the liberals the last few years, announcing a new national program every half an hour and then just forgetting about it and moving on to the next one. When I was a provincial cabinet minister, I saw the consequences of that with families who were hoping that some big federal announcement was going to change their life. And then the cynicism that they showed when they realized that the feds were just being cynical themselves and moving on to the next sweet treat to try and see what they could get out of that in terms of popularity. And so it's trying to push through that idea that democracy is past its sell-by date, that you know we need to go back to a world of strong men deciding politics. I think that's the heart of what all Canadians need to be thinking about right now, is how do we protect that, you know, these incredible structures that we have managed to build up as a country and not fall prey to extremists on left or right.
Are there any Canadian prime ministers or premiers that hold views that are similar to those of the Canadian or the Canada Future Party?
It's hard to say. I mean, we're a new party. And one of the reasons why we started the new party, we've got people like Peter Kent, who is a former Harper cabinet minister, Denis Blanchet, who's a former NDP MP under Jack Layton, people who've been senior liberal organizers, people across the spectrum. And one of the reasons that we wanted to build a new party is that when you're stuck in the old parties, they all have interest groups to which they are beholden. And it is very difficult when you're in the progressive conservative party to push back against some business interests, generally the larger businesses. In the liberals, also the larger businesses, but some of the folks from the different nonprofit communities have an outsized say. Medical societies, another example. And building a party that is interest group proof is really, I think, one of the only ways you can end up with a party that's evidence-based, because you're making it clear that you recognize the damage that interest group politics can do to delivery of services. And you can't go to the nutty populist extreme that some folks, including some of those around Mr. Poilievre, will claim, of saying that, well, you know, we should ban all lobbying and claim we're not going to talk to anything. That's just nonsense. Lobbying is just talking to people. The problem is when people are stopping conversations from happening, not when conversations do happen. And that's why we don't have conversations about reforming supply management, why we don't have conversations about reforming Medicare, so we can preserve a universal single-payer system, but absolutely include some competition, because that's not a problem anywhere else in the world that has a mixed system. You can walk down through the list of things that we just don't talk about in Canada. The fact that today, again, we're having a national conversation about high-speed rail while our sovereignty is under threat, and if the world superpower has its say, our country won't exist to open that new train line. So I can absolutely tell you some folks who I admire in different ways. Doug Ford standing up for Canada recently, good for him. Tim Houston's announcement and talking about eliminating provincial trade barriers, something that my party wants to put on the table because I don't think the provinces, sadly, are going to agree until the feds impose it. But all power to Mr. Houston for that. Wab Kanu in Manitoba, his standing up for Canada and a more sane, evidence-based version of social democracy. I think if the NDP had Wab Kanu as their national leader, they'd be in a very different place. There are people who I admire from across the spectrum. Anthony Housefather, the MP from Montreal, one of the only Jewish members of that caucus who has stood up and taken astonishing abuse from members of his own team, as well as Islamists and other extremists in his community. So I think that one of the things we need to do is remind ourselves that most people in politics do get into it for good reasons, and it structures and institutions that make it hard for them to do the job that they want to do. And so if you want to change those structures and institutions, you got to step back and build an approach and a plan that allows you to do that rather than just tinkering with them to make them go 1 or 2 degrees in either direction, which is what we've tended to see from most of our governments. Radical rhetoric, not much action. We need to have some real change to make our programs deliver for Canadians before Canadians give up on either the idea that a government can deliver programs or give up on the idea of Canada. Both of those questions are left unanswered today. And I hope my party is going to be able to contribute to answering both of those questions in a positive way and mapping out some ideas that my party gets to put them in place. Awesome. The other parties steal them. That's fine too. Because as far as policies go, we need to stop treating those as being state secrets and treat them as national gifts that we share with each other party to party and work to improve them. Just like all parties have, with absolutely limited results, done their best to try and improve Medicare, pension plans, and other inheritances from previous generations. We just need to continue that in a more thoughtful way and recognize the huge changes that this particular moment in history are imposing on our decision makers and on our country as a whole.
What are some of the highlights of the Canadian Future Party's agenda that stand out from the major parties that we have right now?
So a couple of big ones. The first, obviously, and I'm going to keep on highlighting issues around national defense and sovereignty because of the crisis we're in, that we were last November at our founding convention, we passed a policy of meeting NATO targets as quickly as we could and moving to 3%. And I have approval from my party's council to move to a 5-in-5 approach, that we need to be talking about going to 5% of GDP within 5 years. That is the minimum spend required to make sure that we can have a force that's a reasonable deterrent to any country that wishes to commit acts of aggression against us, whether it's the Russians up north or the Americans to the south. The only way that bullies respond is if they know they might get a bloody nose if they start to push people around. So moving aggressively on that file. And some consequences to it, which I'm again shocked we're not talking about. We need to immediately cancel our contracts with American defense providers. It's great that we've bought some F-35s that we're going to start getting in a couple of years, but do we really want to have high-end technology that the U.S. functionally has operational control over? If they decide to cut off the spare parts, we're not going to be able to keep those planes flying. Things like that, where we need to take a clear-eyed, unemotional view of what's happening in the U.S. and redirect our trade and security ties to other democracies. So we're going to push for Canada being the center of a global alliance of democracies that would include Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, other countries in Latin America and Africa, as well as our European partners. And that's a fundamental reshaping, I think, of Canada's place in the world. But we can do that if we want to. We went from having no Navy at all to the third biggest fleet in a couple of years during World War II with a much smaller population and economy. There's no reason we can't do those things again and turn building a successful defense industry in this country into a force for good to help expand and strengthen democracy around the world, to defend other Democrats who are suffering from attacks from autocrats, as Canada is sadly having to endure right now. A couple of other areas, making democracy deliver. We got to get rid of interprovincial trade barriers. What on earth are we waiting for? What we're waiting for, I would argue, is a federal party that is not linked to provincial parties, who will always listen again to those special pleadings from special interest groups saying, well, you can't do that because of this. So we've got to look at how we reform those arrangements so that Canada is truly one country with provinces that have their distinct responsibilities. But let's be clear about federal versus provincial jurisdiction, because as a provincial minister, I saw it every day. that the feds would try and spend money on something that was provincial and then take the credit. And the province would try and take credit for something the feds were doing. And it's a needless mess that can be fairly easily sorted out by a federal government saying, here are our areas of responsibility. This is how we are going to handle them. And you guys do what you're going to do. And there'll be some strings on the money we send, because those strings always are there. But there should be reasonable and minimal. And we should make it clear that the provinces have the tools they need to succeed or fail on their own. So redefining that federal relationship. And adding on to making democracy deliver, I mentioned healthcare. We have a healthcare policy which would preserve a single-payer system, not cost any more money, not take away from the public system. Most of our hospitals aren't used evenings and weekends. Most of our surgeons, one of the reasons they leave for the States and elsewhere, is because they can't get enough surgery time. Let's allow surgeons to rent facilities from our public hospitals when they're closed. They cover all the costs and a surcharge, which they would have to pay to the province. So the province wins. The doctor wins because they're doing the surgery off provincial books and can get paid for it. And someone comes off the waiting list, meaning that the 9 to 5 hours that those surgeries were always being performed within, those can take can further work on reducing the waiting list. It would make the province's money and reduce the waiting lists and improve surgeon retention. And it preserves a single payer system where you don't have anyone paying above what the province would accept as a charge from a doctor for a surgery. So ideas like that, being creative within the spirit of maintaining our universal healthcare program. Because the problem we have with the Liberals, no one trusts them to deliver on anything, just thinks they're just going to waste money, which is fair based on their record. And when the Tories talk about health reform, everyone assumes they're actually secretly talking about getting rid of universal healthcare because too many conservatives support that idea. So as a party that, again, is sort of trying to present ourselves as being in the hard center, that to me is a signature policy that encapsulates what we're all about. Strong, universal social programs reinforced by the power of the market to expand the reach and impact of those programs and make life better for Canadians. That seems to me pretty important. We can keep on going down through the list. We need to be looking at making our country more competitive. We need to be looking at how we can focus when we are talking about, for example, dealing with post-secondary education. What exactly do we want out of that sector in the 21st century? Having everyone go to university to get a Bachelor of Arts degree hasn't worked so well. When I was education minister, we had tens of thousands of kids who wanted to take shop classes in high school, which we'd gotten rid of decades ago for reasons that now are obviously a mistake. I was proud to bring back those classes, but in most cases, through the creation of mentorship and apprenticeship programs with private businesses. Why don't we find ways to make sure that people can get online education to supplement what they actually want to do with their life, even if it doesn't mean going to university? Looking at what the jobs of tomorrow are going to be. And that ties to something else that is central to this party, evidence and science. That we're facing a world where the singularity is approaching, artificial general intelligence is going to exceed human capacity sometime very soon, and we then are in an entirely new world where we are not the most intelligent species on this planet, whatever it is that we call the AI. It's not really a species, but you get the point. And figuring out how we handle that technology and social media as one of its dangerous cousins, which has on the one hand brought us all together, but has also allowed us to be influenced and manipulated by bad actors around the world. So really looking at how human beings can biologically adapt to this new technology is something that none of us are paying enough attention to, because we're all caught up in the same species-wide social experiment of being able to talk to each other all the time. And there are clearly huge benefits to that, but we're seeing the huge downsides now. Just before we got on today, I saw that Elections Canada is about to launch an investigation into Elon Musk for interfering in Canada's election using his online platform, something he can do easily. All the finance limits that we have in Canada, we have very strict rules here for our elections. It's pretty easy to circumvent those if you're a foreign billionaire ready to pump nonsense into the phones, computers, and minds of Canadians. And I'll close with one other thing that makes this party different. And it's something that also costs no money. And it's something that any party leader could do the day the next House of Commons sitting begins. We copied our parliamentary system from the Brits, except one part. In the UK, if you're a backbench MP, you're expected to vote for your party platform. And that's pretty much it. After that, your leader's job is to convince you as an MP, as a politician, about the merits of each bill that comes up. And if they can't, then they won't vote for you. Tony Blair, when he was prime minister, had a bunch of labor rebels, including Jeremy Corbyn, who became leader afterwards for a while, Corbyn was on the hard, hard left, hated Blair, voted against him hundreds and hundreds of times. There was no issue with that. He continued to remain as a Labour MP. And in Canada, there's nothing to stop us from doing that. And it would stop situations like we saw Mr. Trudeau fall into, and Mr. Harper before him, and most of our prime ministers who served for past their sell-by date, that if your MPs feel they've got not just the power, but they should come and tell you that their constituents don't like a bill, and that's why you're going to vote against it. It forces leaders to have a back and forth relationship with their MPs rather than their MPs just being voting machines every day and then really only participating in politics when an election rolls around. And it gives leaders not just an incentive, but a responsibility to listen to the bad news from the troops, because then you're going to know what's coming at you. Today, none of the MPs have any incentive to tell their leaders what's really going on, because they'll get fired or pushed to the backbenches if they're in cabinet or shadow cabinet. So that's a change that would literally require nothing except political will. And if I could close that long answer to your question about what makes my party different, it's that political will. I've shown that in the past. Look at my political record, what I did here in New Brunswick with COVID, what I've done on multiple files. I am good at pushing things through. And what we need right now in Canada is a team that's going to push things ahead and push things through and fight for Canada's future. I didn't realize it at the time, but the name Canadian Future Party was a little bit more prescient than I might have realized.
I have a question about education. How do you feel about making post-secondary education free or at least more affordable?
So this is, I always try and be very careful about to sort of process issues, because this is not a party position. So I can give my personal opinion here, and I'll obviously take this position to my party when we're working on platforms and such. But my personal opinion is that university should be free to the smaller number of people who actually should go to university. I use my province as an example of how I think we fundamentally dumbed down universities. We've had a literacy problem in Canada for a while. Do you know what Canada's overall illiteracy rate is? Just even approximately.
I'm not sure, no.
It's around 50%. Not joking, 50%. Functionally illiterate. And that means that you really can't use the written word in your day-to-day life. And in New Brunswick, it's 56%. Some of the provinces, it's in the high 40s for illiteracy. So New Brunswick's 56% functionally illiterate. And our public universities here all have mandatory reading and writing classes in first year. And that's absolutely insane. Yeah, we went from having public school systems that used to teach kids Latin and Greek in elementary and high school to not teaching our first language until you really get to university. We should not be outsourcing and functionally privatizing literacy. So I think there needs to be a fundamental refocus on making sure that our K-12 students, K-12 in New Brunswick, you know, the range differs from province to province, that those students have a firm grounding. Then I would argue, this is the argument I made when I was education minister, from grade 10 onwards, they should be able to pursue other interests, whether those are in pursuing an apprenticeship in a trade, but equally going on to take university courses. And one of my first acts as minister was to overrule a departmental recommendation not to let our students take university classes, our high school students and any students, because we did have some kids who were in grade 3 who were taking university math. Why not? Let them pursue their passions at the level to which they are able. And I think universities should be treated the same way. Let's make our university centers of excellence, not places where people are expected to go before they get their first job. Especially as I'm 54. In my lifetime, I've seen it go from university being not required to now you need to have a master's degree to get service industry jobs in some places. It's ludicrous. So redefining and revaluing a university education and unabashedly saying this is for people who want to pursue an academic career or it's one of the other specialties that are handled at universities. We shouldn't be ashamed of that. And we've got to break ourselves away from this idiotic idea that there's something disrespectful about pursuing a trade or not going to university. You know, that some of the most brilliant people in the world haven't gone through post-secondary education. And I do not understand how burdening young Canadians with tens of thousands of dollars of debt so that they are marginally employable in a world filled with people in an identical position. I think all that's benefiting is the banks and the universities, where the chancellors and senior administrators pay themselves more money than most provincial premiers and cabinet ministers get. It's just bizarre. So I think there needs to be a real, real hard talk with our universities about what they are doing and how they're going to help Canada succeed. And getting back to talking about excellence and achievement in universities and making sure that students have the right to choose their path to a good, solid life in the middle class, assuming we can hang on to that with all the chaos. And that doesn't have to be with universities. So I think we got to reframe the conversation away from universities to education throughout life available to people. Because also, if you're a plumber, why can't you take some philosophy classes? And to your point, why shouldn't they just be free? There's no reason we can't rejig this model. The one we've built has only been built in recent decades. And it's, again, not doing a very good job, given that we're seeing a degradation of the quality of degrees year on year on year. Employers not really paying attention to bachelor's degrees anymore. This can't continue. We're just going to burden our young people with the costs of maintaining upper class living, the standards of living for highly paid university administrators, which I don't think has much to do with universal high quality education.
I do know some people vote conservative, not necessarily because they're socially conservative, but because they're opposed to carbon taxes or they're opposed to other governments raising taxes on small businesses. How would the Canadian Future Party deal with small businesses or people that are opposed to things like a carbon tax?
Well, the small business side, I mean, that's most of that is handled, you know, through the provincial taxation levels. But I think we need to get our taxes down for those companies as much as possible. They are, by definition, small. Most small businesses struggle mightily in the first few years they survive. A lot of them die after a year or two because the burden is so high. And one of the areas where we can make a huge difference, another area which is totally left alone by our federal government, because it is big and complicated, but it's no less important because of its complexity, something that a lot of the Baltic countries and some other European states have moved very far ahead of us on. We need to talk about simplifying government administrative procedures, that it should be effortless to start a business online for free in a couple of minutes. I believe in Sweden, the expectation is that it takes less than 5 minutes. And there are similar numbers you'll see in other countries across that area of the world. So doing what we can to reduce that administrative burden using the technology that currently AI is being used largely to undermine democracy. Why don't the democracies use AI to empower the public and private sector? We could make things work so much more efficiently if we used electronic record keeping, if we allowed information to flow more easily between different parts of the government while maintaining a very hard shell of protection around government information as a whole. But you know, I think of one example that relates to your question. When I was education minister again, we had a bill that had to put through the legislature to allow a piece of information to be passed from the New Brunswick Department of Education to the New Brunswick Department of Health. Just madness. You know, that you would that's clearly was not the intention of the privacy rules. But we've become so bound up with our bureaucracy, our government is so constipated that it needs a good dose of laxative to get things moving again. And that shouldn't be what Mr. Musk is doing in the States, of just taking a chainsaw to things. It should be looking at how do we make democracy work? How do we make democracy deliver? And making sure that small businesses can have as effortless a path through registration and taxes every year is a good way to do that. Carbon taxing. So first off, really important to say, couple of things I really enjoy saying after the fights that I've had to go through in both the NDP and the Conservative parties about this. We believe in climate change. We believe it is caused by humans, but we also don't think that's particularly important, because the big thing that's important is that it exists. It's going to change our country and the world. And as the people who are responsible for participating, at least in the government of this country, we hope that we can prioritize fixing those problems. And we need to be investing in research and development to find solutions to the carbon crisis, not 50 years down the road, not based on artificial international targets with a large number of countries who could give a damn whether their own people die in the smog or we do, but things that Canada can do right now. So I'm much less concerned about carbon tax or not carbon tax than I am about massive investment in the research and development sector on environmental tech, which coincidentally and fortuitously, given the crisis we're in, has significant overlaps with the defense sector. So there's opportunities there to build Canada again into that northern democratic superpower to be able to push back on climate change, because we have wasted more oxygen talking about climate over the last few years for worse results than just about any developed country. And listening to the party that announced this plan now saying that they don't support it anymore is really kind of a sad comment again on how we just have not been able to make democracy deliver in Canada the last few years. But again, part of that is the opposition hasn't been give us a better carbon plan. It's been the Conservatives in many cases saying it doesn't exist, that climate change doesn't exist. So if you're going to be evidence-based, when, even when it hurts, that means accepting that things are real, but equally, it means figuring solutions for them and not just watching the problems roll past you or thinking that just by putting a fancy label on something and spending money on it is somehow going to fix it. We've got to start talking about how we actually measure results. And that would be our approach across any area of policy, whether business, the environment, defense, interprovincial relations, and so on.
This next issue I want to talk about is something that has divided Canadians for the past 5 years, at least, and that is gun control. Does the Canadian Future Party have a position on gun control?
Yeah, and I would argue it's been used as an issue to divide Canadians for longer than that. The first federal campaign I ran was for Michelle Dockrell, who is a receptionist at a health clinic in Cape Breton. And she was running against Dave Dingwall, who was one of the most powerful ministers in the Chrétien cabinet. And the Chrétien government back in the day, this was 97, had introduced a bill, C-67, if I recall correctly, that was beginning the process of creating the gun registry. And I strongly recommended and won that argument with my team that we campaigned against that, saying that we were in rural Cape Breton and our gun laws were already sufficient. And 20 plus years on from then, it drives me crazy that the Liberals and Conservatives continue to use this as a wedge issue. Canada does not have a problem with legal guns. We just don't. I'm not a firearm owner, but I do not understand how we continue to pretend that we are the United States. The United States has an enormous firearms problem. It's insane. Their laws are ridiculous. We are not them. We've got strict licensing requirements and we've got strict ownership requirements. And I don't see anything that's changed in the last few years that required the most recent flurry of liberal announcements. And it's also odd that if something's a deadly evil weapon 1 year, why don't you ban it then? There are so many of these guns that have been on the market for decades, and the Liberals pick up a few of them each time so they can continue to divide Canadians by talking about this. And I'm not letting the Conservatives off the hook because they equally come out and say, the Liberals are going to take your guns, which I also don't think the Liberals want. What the Liberals and Conservatives want is to have this as an issue to fight about, because then the Conservatives can, when they need to, rally their more rural base, the Liberals can rally their more urban base, and we can all completely ignore the only real problem with guns in Canada, which is the guns coming across from the Americans. It's just the rules that we have are just, they were just fine when the Liberals were elected. I have not seen any information about any gun issue in Canada that requires government action, except for the illegal guns coming in from the United States. And I'm hoping to get my firearm certificate in the near future. And one of the things that actually my party is encouraging all Canadians to do is get their firearm certificate. And if you're not going to do that, get your first aid certificate. There are little things that we can do that will move the numbers on those two files, the numbers of folks who've got firearm certificates and are Red Cross certified. Those are the sort of things that might make those who are thinking of messing with our country pay a bit more attention. And there's nothing wrong with more people being aware of how to safely operate firearms. So it's destigmatizing and de-Americanizing the firearms debate, I think, is something Canada really needs to do. And we need to just tell the Liberals and the Tories to just shut up when they raise it. Unless they're talking about guns coming across the border, I'm just not interested. We don't have a gun problem in Canada.
Now, I know a lot of people might be hesitant to vote for the Canadian Future Party because right now it's only a minor political party. What advice would you give to the naysayers that might like your party platform, but might be reluctant to vote for you because you're a minor party with no seats in the House of Commons right now?
Yeah, that's obviously a question I'm going to get a lot. And the answer is pretty simple, that if my party was given the honor of forming a government, I'm laying out a clear platform of what we would do. If we have any MPs at all from one on up, we will work with any party around the issues that I've laid out as being important to us. So if you're someone who believes in science and are concerned about the Conservatives' embrace of a number of fairly prominent anti-vaccine activists and assorted other medieval cranks who would risk damaging our public health and killing Canadians. Yeah, but you otherwise like the Conservatives' positions on other things, you can vote for a Canadian Future Party MP, and we will oppose any of those measures, unlike backbench Tory MPs who won't be allowed to speak against their leader. We've already seen what Mr. Poilievre does to dissidents, and certainly we've seen what Mr. Trudeau does to seems to be mainly women who he doesn't get on with in his party. And you would have a voice. And you'd have a voice that also wouldn't be tethered to me as leader, because we would actually be listening to Canadians, because that would be built into our party structure. So if you believe in opening up the House of Commons the way I described, so that MPs become politicians again, not voting machines, vote for the Canadian Future Party. No one else is doing that. If you believe in 5% of GDP on defense in 5 years, in a real plan for reorienting Canada's security and trade relationships to democracies, not getting into bed with China just because we're falling out with the US, but building a democratic coalition that can stand the stresses of the 21st century, just like we were there to help build the coalition that defeated fascism in 45 and helped build the successes of the 20th century. If you want that, the Canadian Future Party is the only party talking about it. If you want reform of our social programs, but still want to have social programs and want to see those programs judged based on their ability to deliver based on what they say they're going to do, vote for the Canadian Future Party, because we have no problem with expanding government programs if evidence suggests that's correct. Equally, we have no problem cutting programs if they don't deliver. And there's a growing resistance to paying taxes for healthcare because most young people can't access it. You know, don't have a family doctor, parents can't get surgeries that they need. Yeah, on and on through the list that all Canadians are familiar with the flaws in our system. But you know, I'm here with a proposal that I laid out a minute ago. No other party has talked about how you could change public health care without destroying it. I'm putting an option on the table. If you want more of that, we got 101 more ideas like that coming from Liberals, Tories, New Democrats, Greens, business and defense leaders who are all the people who are in the core of my party. We're not here to just spend our time bashing the others. We want to talk about how we can make Canada better and, again, build us into that 21st century North American superpower that I was talking about earlier.
Well, I think that's a great way of running a party, because when you go to a municipal meeting, you know, very often they usually talk about what the problems are. They very seldom bash each other, you know, based on what their political alignment is. They want to focus on what the issues are and try to solve the problem. You know, politics aside, you know, we have to figure out a way to fix X, Y, and Z instead of just arguing all the time.
Yeah, and part of it's really difficult because social media, which is increasingly the vehicle through which politics is conducted, encourages us to be more divided and extreme, because the algorithms reward conflict and division and extremism. And if you don't have a vision or an ideology, all you're doing is looking to promote engagement to increase your votes. You walk down that path towards extremism because it generates benefits in the short term. In the medium term, it's pretty clear that it ruins democracies, but that's sadly not something our other parties seem to be taking into account. But I think that model of municipal politics, where even in some parts of the country, we have municipal parties, but there is still a willingness to work together, that from talking to folks from the older generation about what life was like in the New Brunswick legislature, where I spent 6 years, it was normal for people to be friends across party lines. And with only a couple of exceptions, that's nearly disappeared. And so returning that spirit of intentional collegiality of, again, if you're inside the sandbox, being respectful and kind, and if you actually agree with your opponents, tell them you agree. What's wrong with that? Again, and normal people agree with people even if they dislike them some of the time. And this whole idea that politicians have fallen into, where they somehow believe they have to act in a way other than normal humans act, is one of the reasons that people don't treat politicians like normal humans. And it used to be that was a good thing for the politicians because they were treated as being special. But now they're often just seen as being weird and evasive and dishonest. So it's not benefiting the politicians. It's not benefiting the public who are supposed to be served by the politicians. And it's not benefiting the country. So why on earth not change that to something that we know works better? And there's the model that you laid out and the models that we're working on at the heart of the party are trying to do exactly that. We're also, by the way, trying to move towards a real focus or have it right from the beginning, a focus on face-to-face organizing with the party. The opportunities to talk like this, to do Zoom meetings and whatever else, that's great. But if you're going to deal with democracy, people having equal rights to present their opinions and contribute to a decision around a plan to fix a problem, which for me is all democracy, it's really, that's what it is, then meeting face-to-face is the way to do that. I've seen too many times party leaders using Zoom meetings and similar to railroad their caucuses, to force through things that would never have been approved if everyone was in a room together. And it creates a real power disadvantage where the person who is broadcasting, the person who has the most authority, is going to be the one who dictates events. And that is not something that is good for our country. We're seeing that right now. We're seeing the damage that the social mediaification and internetization of politics and democracy is having around the world. It's ripping our society, our civilization apart. So we're not going to ban it. We can't get rid of it, but we do have to figure out how we control and mitigate the downsides of this new tech. And one of the reasons we have to do that is exactly the reason you raised. It's allowing people to get back to agreeing when there are things to agree about. I mentioned Tony Blair again, who, when he was opposition leader back in the early 90s in the UK, got in trouble with the left of his party because he kept on saying to them, look, if we disagree with the conservatives about everything, we just sound disagreeable. We don't. You know, there's in any normal country, any normal democracy, at least, there's probably at least, even in these divided, more extreme times, at least 80% of things that everyone is already on the same page about. And we agree that we should enforce laws, that we should make sure that when we spend money, that there are services delivered. And if we can actually put all the stuff where we agree off to one side, that means that and also give our opponents credit when they do things that are right. I've tried to do that. I gave Mr. Polyever, who I have very little affection for, to be polite about it. But at his rally, he did the thing he had not yet done, which was spoke clearly against President Trump and the 51st state annexation nonsense. And he deserves credit for that. He still has a huge problem with annexationists in his party and extremists and so on, but he did the right thing.
Now, there are a lot of things in the party's policy that we haven't covered, and I imagine that there's a lot of things to cover. So if people are curious about how the party plans to deal with a certain issue, is there a way that they can reach out and have their questions answered?
I'll go one better than that. First, they can reach out to me at leader@thecanadianfutureparty.ca. They can also call me on my cell at 506-238-5550. I've given out my phone number for my whole time in Canadian politics and haven't had particular cause to regret it yet, apart from one guy who called me drunk at 4 a.m. because he was having an argument with his friends about proportional representation, and you know, which is, I guess, that's a good sign that New Brunswickers are spending their time arguing about PR at 4 a.m. But please don't call me between 2 and 6 a.m. Atlantic time. But otherwise, happy to chat with folks. But on policies, first, you can go to our website. Just Google Canadian Future Party. It'll take you there. But also, you'll find on our website a page that is also unlike others, that there's a full template there where anyone who wants to can fill in a fairly exhaustive document that allows them to contribute to our policy process. That you've got to show why the government should do something, how it would do it, how much it would cost, what would the downsides be, how long the program should last, a long list of questions that go into the policy development processes in the world's most advanced democracies. And that's a tool that we're just putting out there so that anyone who wants to can contribute those ideas. They don't have to send them back into us at the end if they don't want to. But it also means that as a party, we are not going to be stuck with policies that were drawn up in the back of a napkin by a couple of people because they thought they sounded good. That if we put something out there, it's going to have some level of detail and depth behind it. But what you're also going to hear from us, because I think this is something that differentiates the Canadian Future Party from our competitors, is we're also going to be saying, you know, every election for the last 20 years, the stuff that dominated the life of the government that was elected, we didn't even know what it was on election day. Yeah, certainly when I was elected in 2018, I didn't imagine that I'd be handling a global pandemic as a major part of my job responsibilities as education minister in New Brunswick. So trying to show our approach to handling problems, to evaluating evidence, because in the end, in our system, we're electing people to use their judgment. And no one's a subject matter expert in everything that comes up before a legislature. What you're electing people to do is to use their judgment on a huge range of different issues. And so I want us to pick some issues to develop in great detail to show how that approach would work when it's sort of carried to the fifth or sixth level. but also because that's the approach that we will use to handle conflict with the U.S., dealing with our EU allies, handling bird flu, healthcare reform, on and on down the list.
I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with us, and I wish you the best of luck in the election.
Well, hey, I'll need all the luck I can get. So again, please do reach out, and anyone who's listening, hope that sparks some interest. And my closing plea in these fairly dark times is, any Canadians out there, get involved, whether it's my party or another one, make your voice heard. We are so lucky to live in a country where we have the right to have our voice heard. Let's not lose it. Let's not be made cynical by the frustrations and failures of the system we have. Let's work to try and make it better. No matter what path you choose to do that, let's work together to make that happen and make this country better.
And that was Dominic Carty, the Canadian Future Party leader. Don't forget, if you haven't done so yet, be sure to register as a voter for the next Canadian federal election. Until next time, here at The Medley, we're all kinds of different.